Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher, and my guest today is Jamila Michener. She's a professor of government at Cornell University and the author of a new book titled Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. The book attempts to make some provocative connections between the Medicaid program, its beneficiaries, its effects on their political views, and their activity. Professor Michener, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's often said that Medicaid is the most poorly understood of the major social welfare programs in this country. And I wanted just to start off by checking in with you. Would you say that's true? And if so, why do you think it's true?
I completely agree with that. Part of the reason is because there's a program called Medicare with a very similar name, but that is, in fact, a very different program. And so Medicare, which is the program that provides health coverage to older Americans who are 65 and older and to all Americans that are over 65, is very different than Medicaid, which is a program that is primarily for low-income Americans to provide them with health coverage and also for people who have severe disabilities. And so that program is means-tested, and it's different. It's not just for everyone below a certain income level. There are a variety of different ways that you become qualified.
And is the fact that it does have that income component to it part of the reason why people don't understand it, because some folks aren't really even thinking of it? Is that it?
Yeah. So when it comes to a program that is, say, for everyone who's 65 and older,
right,
at some point we're all going to get it. We all have parents. We know people who have it. But Medicare, despite the fact that it does affect many people, at this point there are upwards of 70 million people who rely on Medicaid in this country, there are many of us who could go through our whole lives without knowing anyone who's a Medicaid beneficiary. So it is less salient for many folks.
And you even said Medicare there at the beginning, so it's easy to make the flip. Now, Obamacare greatly changed Medicaid, at least in many of the states, and we'll get to that in a minute because your book has a lot to do with that in various ways. But for now, let's just stay with, let's stay with the program before Obamacare and how it worked. And you've already described it a little bit. Could you say a little bit more about how its fundamental approach is and what it's trying to accomplish?
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental approach of Medicaid is really about making sure that the most vulnerable citizens are able to have access to health insurance. And usually the most vulnerable citizens are those who are low income, so who don't have enough money to be able to pay for or receive insurance through their employers like most people do. Often those folks are people who fall into the category of having disabilities or severe chronic illnesses. And so there are some groups of people who may not be as poor, who may not be as low income, but if you have a severe enough illness, that's going to mean that your health coverage is going to cost thousands or millions of dollars. You may qualify for Medicaid. So Medicaid is really about providing health insurance coverage for vulnerable populations. Many beneficiaries are children, about 50% on average, and making sure that those folks have access to health care.
Now, it also has a large role, as I understand it, in nursing home care and other long-term care, and that gets even less attention, I think, in the public's eye. So it's a big part of the program. Talk about that aspect.
Yeah, the nursing home care aspect is interesting because it's a big part of the program to the extent that a disproportionate share of the cost of Medicaid are actually going towards elderly people who need nursing home care. And that's really a feature of the American healthcare system where there's no real long-term care options. And so many elderly people, even those who indeed when they were, you know, not elderly, were middle class, get to a point where their assets get spent down and they can't pay for their nursing home care. And so Medicaid covers that, which is a really important function. So even though only about 10% of Medicaid beneficiaries are elderly, they're taking up a much larger share of the program's resources because long-term care is expensive. So that matters. It affects the kind of prospects and the cost of Medicaid.
And so now a much more complicated question. how did Obamacare change the Medicaid program, or at least try to?
Yeah. So Obamacare tried to change Medicaid by saying, instead of the kind of patchwork program that we had where, you know, in some states, if you were an adult, you couldn't qualify for Medicaid, no matter how poor you were, right? And in other states, you had to be 100% of the poverty line, right at the poverty line. And in other states, it was 200, and there was this patchwork.
And part of that patchwork, just to make it clear to our listeners, is, to jump in here, is a patchwork of the way it's paid for, right? That there's this sharing between the national and the state governments, and maybe we should talk about that, too.
Go ahead. So Medicaid is an intergovernmental program. So it's not a program that the federal government is just paying for altogether. The federal government is paying a certain portion of the cost, and that varies depending on which state. And the states are paying the remaining portion. Mm. And so the federal government has basic guidelines that they hand down for how the program should be organized, and the states also have a lot of discretion for deciding more specific elements of how the program is organized and designed. So it really is about a power-sharing arrangement between the states and the federal government.
So then Obamacare comes in and tries to do what?
So Obamacare tries to sort of provide some sort of uniformity, right, or a kind of baseline. And the baseline is everybody who's at 138% of the poverty line and below gets Medicaid, right? You don't have to sort
of— Regardless of the state.
Regardless of the state. That was the sort of original intention of Obamacare. And you don't have to fit into lots of other different categories. You don't have to necessarily be a pregnant woman or necessarily have a chronic illness. You just have to be an adult who is living in or near poverty. That was the intention of Obamacare, but that's not what happened.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Jamila Michener, a professor at Cornell University and the author of Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. So let's get into that a little bit. Obamacare tries to put this one level that everyone falling under will be eligible for Medicaid. And what is the mechanism in which that it does this?
So initially, Obamacare says if you get funds from the federal government for Medicaid, and every state does, and every state gets a lot, unless you do this, unless you expand the program to everyone below a certain poverty level, we're going to take away all your funds. And there was really no—
All your Medicaid funds. That you're getting from the national government.
Yeah, which is for billions of dollars, right, and more or less depending on which state. But for every single state, that is a very significant part of their budget. And so the threat of having that taken away was a substantial lever for getting compliance from states.
And what was the carrot? That was the stick. What was the carrot?
The carrot was we will cover this. We will pay initially the full cost of this, right? And then after a certain period, we'll kind of pull back and we'll pay less and less. But so initially covering this additional population that you get through the expansion is free. The states are getting it for free. And as time goes by, you know, the federal government will pull back and expect the states to pay for more and more of this, but they'll still be getting a tremendous, you know, 90% of this covered by the federal government. So you're getting a lot of people in your state insured, and eventually you end up paying something, but really a small fraction of the overall cost.
So then what happens in the story? Now there's this lawsuit, right?
Some
of the states are not thrilled with getting this.
Many
help
of the
from
states
the national government.
Are enough of the states are not happy about this that they sue. They take this. It ends up going all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court says, well, look, this is essentially you starting a new program, right? Or it's the equivalent of it. It's different enough. And you're threatening to take away the existing funds. You're using that as you said, the stick. And that amounts to coercion. So the states don't really have a choice about whether they should opt in or opt out. You're threatening to take away so much from them that you're coercing them. And the Supreme Court says this will not go. The state should have the choice, and they don't lose their existing funds if they choose not to do it. So now it's the Wild West as far as what decisions states are going to be making about whether or not to expand Medicaid.
And the states that tended to accept the money and those that tended not to accept tend to fall out on the political lines that we'd expect, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, that doesn't hold across the board. There are some states that decide to expand Medicaid, like Arizona, that are kind of traditionally conservative. But for the most part, we see that lots of the sort of northeastern, western states that are traditionally considered more liberal states decide to expand. And many of the states in the South and the ones we think of as more conservative decide not to. So we end up in this situation where, you know, 30, 31 of the states are expanding, 19 are not. And there's, again, back to the patchwork, right? There's really uneven decisions being made across the country.
I remember John Kasich, you know, pursuing the Republican nomination, kind of staked out the more left position among the Republicans by saying, well, you know, I led that effort to take the expansion.
Yeah, Ohio was another one of those states that was perhaps not a usual suspect, but that did end up doing this.
So now we'll get to your book. So you look at the Medicaid program, and you look at it from the standpoint of those who are using it, or in some cases trying to use it and not being able to. That sort of ties in with the discussion that we just had about the unevenness. And we'll explore your findings on that in a few minutes. But I wanted to ask you first, how'd you get the idea for this project? Why'd you want to do this?
That's a great question. So originally, I mean, my research focuses on poverty, inequality, race, with a particular emphasis on how the government shapes life in communities that are low income and disproportionately populated by people of color. And I was working on just trying to understand what does the government mean for folks in these communities? And I started doing interviews. I started talking to people. Instead of assuming that I knew, I went into communities and asked people what was important to them. Medicaid was not on my radar.
Interesting.
It wasn't, but it was on theirs. Huh. And it came up again and again and again. And I got to a point where I realized it would be disingenuous to not approach it. I was intimidated by Medicaid. It's this behemoth of a program. It's a labyrinth in terms of the ins and outs. And I thought, can I understand this? But people were trying to figure out how it was working in their lives, and I couldn't ignore it.
So how did you go about the researching and the writing? What more specifically did you do in order to produce the book?
Yeah, well, I was lucky enough to be able to have a 2-year period where I could really sort of immerse myself in studying Medicaid. On the one hand, I traveled all over the country interviewing Medicaid beneficiaries and bureaucrats and administrators, trying to understand how they understood the program, how it operated in their lives, how it affected them. I also looked at a lot of data from large surveys. So I identified a handful of large surveys around the country, some of which had interviewed people who were Medicaid beneficiaries. I found some surveys that interviewed large numbers of Medicaid beneficiaries, thousands of them. And then I could get some larger sort of more generalizable data about what Medicaid beneficiaries were thinking and experiencing. And finally, I also looked at administrative data. So that means I went to the states and I said, give me information about Medicaid beneficiaries in your state. Are they filing fair hearings? What's happening to them that you're keeping track of as a government agency? A lot of that is publicly available information. If you ask for it, the government has to give it to you. And so I really used different kinds of information to try to kind of triangulate, to understand from different perspectives what was going on with Medicaid in the United States.
We'll get more into the findings of your book when we come back. You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Jamila Michener. She's a professor of government at Cornell University and the author of Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. So let's get into the findings of your book here. What did you learn then about the effects of Medicaid on the beneficiaries' views about government and on their political activity and their political senses more generally?
Yeah, I'm a political scientist, so I paid attention to the research that talked about Medicaid's effects on health and finances and all sorts of things, but I wanted to think about how it affected people's political lives. And what I found, what I thought I would find, is that I'd get an answer one way or the other. It had a positive effect. It had a negative effect. And to a certain extent, I found that the overall relationship between Medicaid and different kinds of political participation, like voting or registering to vote or being a part of a political group or taking part in a political demonstration, that relationship was negative, meaning that people who were enrolled in Medicaid were less likely to do those things. They were less likely to participate politically. And that was true even when I controlled for the obvious things that we might think would make people enrolled in Medicaid less likely to do those things. So we could control for their income. We could control for their race. We could control for what neighborhood they lived in and all sorts of other things that make Medicaid beneficiaries unique, their health. But there was still that negative relationship such that Medicaid beneficiaries were less likely to participate in politics. And so I thought that was the full story at first.
And then what happened?
Then as I talked to people, I realized that they kept talking about place, about where they lived, about the state they lived in, the county they lived in, the neighborhood they lived in. And I realized that the answer of, well, Medicaid has a negative effect, was not the full answer. Because it appeared that the role Medicaid played in people's lives was varying across place.
So were there some groups or some people for whom Medicaid had an empowering effect that you were finding?
Yeah. So, for example, there were particular states where I identified in – when I looked at Medicaid beneficiaries, for example, just in Wisconsin, right? Now, this was data from 2004. So Wisconsin 2004 and Wisconsin now are pretty different, especially in terms of Medicaid. But when I looked at just that state, I found that those Medicaid beneficiaries, Medicaid boosted their participation in politics. It did not diminish it. But when I looked at Virginia or California, Medicaid seemed to diminish people's political participation. Hmm. And still other states like Michigan, there was no effect, right? And so there was variation. It really depended on where you lived.
And what would be the factors that would lead to a diminishing of engagement and activity? Was it a fear of, hey, if I get involved in stuff, I'm risking losing this? Or what was it?
It was really about the experience of receiving Medicaid benefits and the messages that sent to beneficiaries. And those messages were different in different places. So in states, for example, where the program was retracting, right? Benefits were being taken away. Budgets were being cut. Beneficiaries woke up one day and they didn't have something that they had before. Suddenly, no dental coverage, no, you know, podiatry coverage. Can't get that bunion taken care of, right? And that feeling of loss really it awoke them. It sensitized them to how much the state was capricious. It was arbitrary. Why was yesterday different than today? Why could I go to the dentist last year and not this year? So that sort of thing, when states were taking things away, that made a big difference in people's lives. Similarly, when states were giving more, right? So when I compare people in states that expanded, provided more generous benefits to those that did not, those people in the states providing more generous benefits were more likely to participate. So again, when states took away and when they gave, I see political participation move with those kinds of factors.
So federalism then has this kind of appearance in your book as kind of a character in the story in and of itself. So say a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the first thing I'll say is that federalism sounds really boring. I remember taking a class on it as a graduate student and I thought, I can't make it through. But what I found when I started thinking about what it meant in people's lives was that it's really interesting. So because of federalism, the national government doesn't just say to states, here's what you have to cover in your Medicaid program. Here's what you have to do. We are all going to march to the beat of the same drummer. Instead, federalism creates an institutional context, a political environment where states are given discretion, they're given leeway, they're given freedom. And in turn, states turn around and they give discretion to counties or to cities. And that entire structure of different levels of government being able to design things differently is what explains why you may be able to get physical therapy if you're a Medicaid beneficiary in one state and not in another. You may be able to get hospice care at the end of your life in one state and not in another. And simply crossing a border can have a huge impact on what you have access to, because federalism says that states and localities need to have flexibility and freedom to design and implement and administer programs.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Cornell University professor Jamila Michener. So you then are making it sound, at least to my ears, as if federalism is a bit of a problem here. And I wanted to push on that just a little bit and, okay. and ask you, do you see federalism and the fact that it is this shared program and there is this variation place to place serving any positive purposes in this policy realm?
So when I first started off, I did think of federalism as a bad thing. I thought it's spawning inequality. And as a general kind of stance, I don't like inequality. But as I learned about more and more specific examples and cases, I came to realize that that view was too simplistic. Federalism is, in a way, value neutral, right? It's about the structure of our system, but whether it produces inequality, whether it produces good or bad outcomes, is about the way that we use that system. And so the point of the book isn't to say federalism is bad, because there are some states that are doing that are expanding and giving people more and boosting participation, and that's good.
That
right?
old laboratories of democracy argument,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right? So it's not about federalism being bad or good, but it's about us being aware of what these different processes look like across place so that we can identify the good and think about how to make sure that that is available more equitably across place.
Now, you spent a lot of time talking to people, as you described. I was curious to know, was there one person or one story that you encountered in all of this that as you worked on this book really kind of stayed in your head, maybe even haunted you, you know, as you continued to work on it?
Yeah, I would say that's probably a woman that I met in Michigan. I call her Shanna. These are all pseudonyms to protect people's identities. But in the book, I call her Shanna. Young woman, she was in nursing school at the time. You know, her and her husband were from a very low income background. They didn't have much opportunity, but they were trying to improve their lives. She was going to nursing school. He was working to keep the family together while she got her degree. They had a young son who had a chronic kidney disease, and her husband had epilepsy. And Michigan decided that it was going to, for working adults who were on Medicaid, it was going to make them pay a fee every month to stay on the program. They decided for Shanna and her husband, Tim, that the fee would be $400 a month. They did not have $400 a month. His Medicaid lapsed. He had an epileptic seizure and bit off a big chunk of his own tongue. They didn't go to the emergency room because they were afraid that they would go and find out that they weren't covered, that Medicaid would not pay for it, until his tongue started to turn green. Mm. And then they went, and they did find out that Medicaid wouldn't cover it, but he was treated, and they just had a huge hoard of bills to pay. And, you know, Shanna really stood out to me because she just thought, you know, this is government. They give, they take away. What can you do? I like to think that if my husband bit off his tongue, I would be like, something has to change. I'm in a fight. Every incentive to push back, I thought. But that wasn't the way she responded. And it really struck me that government has a huge role in people's lives and that we have a responsibility for figuring out what that is and empowering people to create change when change is what's needed.
And so there's been a lot of concern expressed recently that the new tax law that has been passed is somehow going to have – there's another shoe that's going to drop more than one shoe. And one of those is going to be regarding Medicaid, and it will lead to reductions in the program for one reason or another. Do you see that? Do you have that concern? And how would you sort that out?
I always have that concern with Medicaid. It's a program that is simultaneously politically strong and politically vulnerable. Mm. It's politically strong on the one hand because some of the recipients of Medicaid are children, folks who are disabled, people we are very sympathetic towards and care about a lot. It's also politically vulnerable because there are some other people, like non-working, you know, adults who rely on Medicaid who maybe the public doesn't view and as positive as a light. And so there's always this pull, right? I think when we decide to invest lots of money into lightening the tax load of disproportionately very, very wealthy people, and resources are to some extent limited, then the question is, who will lose, right? And in our political system, the answer is, frankly, you know, probably two more frequently than we would like it to be, those who have the least. And Medicaid beneficiaries inhabit that space. And my findings suggest that many of them are not just that they're disempowered, but that their very experiences with Medicaid are disempowering them, right? And unevenly so.
Exactly the story that you told when you told that one person.
Exactly.
Go ahead, though. Sorry.
And unevenly so. And it's not only a story of disempowerment, but to the extent that some people are being disempowered, then the ability of a program like Medicaid to sustain itself, to defend itself, is sort of hindered and hampered. So I always worry about that. But I also think that Medicaid has proven resilient. And it's so important for so many people. We're talking at this point 74 million Americans. That it's a big target, even when you have the House and the Senate and whichever political party. So it's no easy thing, but there's still a certain amount of risk there.
We've only got about a minute left, but I also wanted to give you a chance to tell me, what are you working on now? This book's out, so what are you working on now?
I'm working on a few things. Some things relevant to Medicaid. So some of the states, Kentucky just passed, just had this waiver that now says they can require Medicaid beneficiaries to work, so Medicaid work requirements. And I'm starting to think about what the effects of that sort of thing are. And then I'm also working on a project that's about civil legal representation. So what that is essentially is if somebody like a Medicaid beneficiary loses their benefits, they can go to the court system to try to find redress. And I try to understand when low-income people go to the court system and they're looking for help in civil matters, not criminal matters, can they find it, right? And how does that vary, going along with what I found in the book, in different places?
Well, when those are done, we'll have to have you back on. That was Jamila Michener. And again, her new book is titled Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. Jamila, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.